Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking to Mr. James Wasserman, who's written several books, but the two we're going to be talking about. The first is The Secrets of Masonic Washington. The Secrets of Masonic Washington, a guidebook to sign symbols and the ceremonies of the origins of America's capital. And the second is a book called The Templars and the Assassins, which is really a fascinating insight into the Knights Templar, and you can't understand so much of what's going on today unless you understand the Templars. And this is what it says on the back of the book. 1,000 years ago, Christians battled Muslims for possession of a strip of land upon the which both religions were founded. And these crusades changed the course of Western history, but less known is the fact that they were also the meeting ground for two legendary secret societies, the Knights Templar and their Muslim counterparts, the Assassins. In this book, The Templars and the Assassins, The Militia of Heaven, occult scholar and secret society member James Wasserman provides compelling evidence that the interaction of the Knights Templar and the Assassins in the Holy Land transformed the Templars from the Pope's private army into the true occult society from which they would sow their seeds of the Renaissance and the Western mystery traditions. Both orders were destroyed as heretical some 700 years ago, but the Templars' survivors are believed to have carried the secret teachings of the East into the occult background from which sprang both a Renaissance and Masonry. Mr. Wasserman, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan, for having me.
Well, I think your books are fascinating. I've certainly your book on the Secrets of Masonic Washington, I think is important. I think people need to understand that everywhere in Washington, D.C. are the emblems and the signs of the occult traditions hidden in plain sight, as you bring out so beautifully.
Well, you know, what I think is even more important, frankly, than the occult symbolism is the spiritual symbolism. The idea that America is a land built on freedom and built on the nobility of the human soul and the interaction between man and God, which is celebrated by our founders in every document, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, in just every place that those people spoke. They spoke about the nobility of the individual human soul and the gratitude, you know, that we feel to God as a nation.
Well, of course, I agree with you, but then, of course, I remember what Thomas Jefferson said so well, in that in matters of politics and power, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. And that's
well,
why they
absolutely
wrote the Constitution the way that they did, because they feared that one day the people would vote themselves into slavery, because, of course, people always tend to vote for the person who gives them the most, offers them the most, whether it's free medical care or free food or free housing. And then, of course, they end up, of course, voting themselves into slavery. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment. We're going to actually bring on another network. We're going to lose the network we've had for the last 5 minutes. Bring on another network, and then, of course, they'll all be together, hopefully before long. So hang right on there. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest today is Mr. James Wasserman, who's a member of a secret society, and he's simply at the, and you're going to have to pronounce that, is it Ordo Templi Orientis, is that it?
Yes, sir.
All right, fine. And of course, he's been a member for many years, since 1976. He lives in New York, but he's written a number of books about the occult background of the United States. The first book is called The Secrets of Masonic Washington, and it's really a walking tour of Washington, D.C., where you'll find all sorts of occult symbols hidden in plain sight. And then, of course, another book on the Templars and the Assassins, pointing out really that the Templars started out as really the warriors of the Pope, and ended up, of course, being engulfed with these ideas of the mystery religions of the Near East, as so often happens. And then, of course, after they were driven out of up there, they brought these ideas to the United States. And after the Templars were destroyed, in the early 1300s. Why the people who survived have actually utilized that secret teaching and were involved with bringing, first of all, the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, and then, of course, molded the occult traditions which are here in the United States today. Will that be a fair appraisal?
Absolutely. I would say that, you know, the only thing I would emphasize a little bit is that they were part of, you know, that this all came from the Near East, you know, back to Europe, and most of what happened occurred in Europe, and then they came over to the United States with the early settlers. The reason I point that out, sir, is that a number of people have written that, you know, the Knights Templar discovered America, and that's certainly nothing I say in my book.
All right, fine. I concur with your interpretation. The history really goes a great deal into Masonry, its influence on a colonial America, its influence during the Revolutionary War, its information, its influence in some of the ideas that were foundational to America, but even more than that, in the design of our nation's capital, which, of course, you're never going to hear about through ordinary channels. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Now, would you like to talk a little bit about the occult architecture of our nation's capital, from your point of view?
Well, I think, you know, what strikes me is, first place, the inherent beauty and organization of it. In other words, you know that the Constitution calls for a 10-mile area and devoted to the national government, and that area, because of George Washington's influence.
Hold that for just a moment. We bring other stations on board here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, once again, James Wasserman. We're talking about his book on the secrets of Masonic Washington. And of course, Mr. Wasserman points out that George Washington was instrumental, right for the long, a man named Lafont. He was the architect. But these ideas that Washington was to be a unique city, they were building from scratch, but they were going to lay out specific architecture there that would have tremendous occult significance. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yes, I think it is. For one thing, he insisted, Washington himself, as I understand it, is the one who insisted that the 10-mile area that was given by the Constitution be made into a perfect square. And Masons have said that this was designed to show that America was on the level, on the square, that you would get a square deal from America. And of course, the square also represents the four elements, fire, air, earth, and water. And, you know, the idea is that the Holy Spirit manifests within those four elements as the fifth, you know, as the fifth element, the quintessence. And that, of course, is the spirit of liberty as enshrined, I believe, in the Declaration of Independence.
All right, fine. Well, Kristen, we find, you point out, that there are many signs of the zodiac and other occult symbology all throughout Washington, D.C., hidden in plain sight. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Oh, absolutely. I think that I show four complete zodiacs, and there are others. But there's a beautiful zodiac in the Federal Reserve Building, of all places. There are several in the Library of Congress. There is one very important one in the National Academy of Sciences, and there's a beautiful fountain called the Mellon Fountain at the beginning of Federal Triangle, at the eastern end of Federal Triangle. Mellon, of course, was a great financier of the early 20th century and a Mason and a Treasury Secretary. And so, yes, all these zodiacs are really all over the place. But unless you know what you're looking for, they can be decorative. They can be considered quite decorative. They're a beautiful statuary. The Library of Congress is one of the most occult buildings, I think, in the world. It's a true testament to the Enlightenment and to the spirit of inquiry and to the whole concept, I think, of the nobility of the soul.
Well, now, what about the occult influence in the Renaissance? Do you feel that there was a strong occult influence in the Enlightenment in the Renaissance that they came
about? Oh, absolutely. And in the Templar book, that's what I discuss at some length, and I try to make the case that the Crusades were the event that took Western culture, European culture, out of the Dark Ages and exposed it to a richness of culture that at that time was in the East. You know, it's funny because nowadays, you know, the Near East is basically, except for Israel, is basically a jungle of savages, as we learn every day. And that was the case of Europe during the Dark Ages, you know, from, let's say, the 6th to the 10th century. And then all of a sudden we went over there, you know, in this warrior mode because they had attacked, the Islamic cultures had attacked all of Western Europe along Sicily, Spain, and coming across from Turkey. So in an act of self-defense, Europe answered and went abroad to fight. Well, all of a sudden, this richness of culture, which they had at that time, was experienced by, you know, the medieval Christians, and they really began, I think, to realize that the culture that they had left in Europe was not very enlightened and was very oppressive. And in fact, the Muslims at that time had street lamps, they had beautiful silks, they had books, they had vast libraries, they had a very, very powerful scientific tradition. They did a great deal of work in mathematics. They were very much like we are today. And somehow or other, you know, due to the conquest, the later conquests in the 13th and 14th centuries by the Mongols, you know, their culture was essentially wiped out.
But of course, really so much of their knowledge that they had really had its origin in the occult traditions, didn't it?
Well, absolutely, because in the occult traditions, you know, what you have is you have direct access to the Holy Spirit. The idea is that you are looking for ways to tap into divine energy through meditation.
I think that's important. Would you emphasize that? Because it is this belief that the occult tradition is how do you tap into this divine energy through meditation. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yes, through meditation and also through active ritual.
Right.
In other words, the idea that goes back to, it goes back so far, I'm not even going to say where it goes back to, because, you know, we know it existed in Egypt, it existed in Greece, it existed in Rome, it existed in Sumerian cultures. Everywhere we look, it exists. And the idea is that, you know, one traverses the inner planes of the heavens and gains wisdom and knowledge and strength of character to become a better person and to increase in wisdom. Solomon in the Bible was reputed to be a great magician, which meant that he engaged in an active search for God.
Well, of course, it was some of that tapping into this supernatural power. Is that how he became? Was that how the being a magician was exemplified or demonstrated?
Yes, absolutely. And the Templars, I believe, and I'm not talking about the whole order, sir. I mean, I'm not talking about every single knight that went over there, but I'm saying that there was an elite group of people who went over there, made friends with some of the elite group of Muslims that they met over there, and they had a conjoining of the ways, and they taught each other. And I would say at that time it was primarily the Muslims teaching the Christians about their tradition. And their tradition, of course, a lot of it had come from the West in the first place before the breakup of the Roman Empire, or as a result of the breakup of the Roman Empire, the philosophers and occultists of the early years in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century. In the 6th century, they were thrown out of Rome under pain of death, and they went to Persia. So they taught there. And years later, 800 years later, 600 years later, this information came back to the West through the Crusaders.
Well, of course, this is really true even in Masonry today, where an awful lot of Masons really don't understand the secret traditions and the mystery religions. I mean, they're just involved in a fraternity, well, of course, helps them financially and helps them as far as social advancement. They enjoy the associations. And I think it was Manly Hall who said, Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, an outer fraternity of people who are just having a good time, but an inner fraternity of people who already study the Arcanum and the Ancunorum. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Absolutely. The only thing I would add to it is that in addition to promoting their own ends, they also do a great deal of charity work, and they've done, a lot to help to build specifically American culture with building libraries, towns, buildings. They've been a very positive force, especially in America.
All right, fine. Well, of course, our guest is Mr. Wasserman. Are you actually a Mason, or is it your association with the Ordoro Templi Orientis that really has given you the insight into what you write about?
I'm not a Mason. My father was a Mason and very proud of it and always wanted me to become one, but I joined Ordo Templi Orientis and have pursued my study of secret societies and the wisdom traditions in that organization.
And, of course, really, there are secrets. I think it's so hard for most people to really believe that there are secret societies out there, but there really are, and they do have an impact on the world in which we live, don't they?
Yes, and, some are very good and very liberating to the world. I hope that my secret society is one of the good ones, and some, of course, as you well know, are very bad, and, let's say the mafia is a bad secret society that, is not necessarily advancing the interests of humanity as a whole. But equally, some of these groups like the Council on Foreign Relationships, I don't think are much help to the world either. The world government, UN style groups that are trying to quietly and secretly manipulate us into a world government. I think there are some very good secret societies like scientists and scholars who are seeking to broaden, human knowledge. I mean, secret often means that people are just able to get together and discuss what interests them without a lot of interference from the noise of the crowd, so to speak.
What about the assassins? Do they still exist today in any specific form?
They do exist. They're no longer in the military phase of their life. What I write about in my book is about 160 years during which they were active during the Crusades as a military order, a spiritual military order. Now, their proper name actually is Nizari Ismailis. There are several million in the world. They live under the direction of the man known as the Aga Khan.
I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're going to have to bring our stations back. Well, somebody had called in, wanted to know about Columbia. We hear about the District of Columbia. We hear about certainly, she is basically a statue. She's a mythological goddess. But why did they name the area of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia? And what does that have to do with the goddess Columbia?
Well, strangely enough, Columbia is a personified female form of Columbus, Christopher Columbus, the discoverer of America. And when, in the 18th century, he was a national hero, they didn't have much concern about his offending the Indians back in those days, you know. He was the national hero of America, and America was very likely to have been named Columbia itself, but they chose the name America, and Columbia was the name chosen for the district because it represented the female personification of Columbus.
I think that's fascinating, and I think there's so much here. And of course, as you point out in your book, there is so much sculpture, so many statues there on the buildings in Washington, D.C. that do represent the ancient goddesses and gods. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. It's breathtaking, especially if you know what you're looking at.
But the thing, the tragedy is that most people don't know what they're looking at. They go to Washington, D.C., they take a tour, they look around, but they don't understand the significance of the statues that they would find there. Statues like certainly the one of Francis Bacon. I mean, how many Americans have any idea who Francis Bacon was or what part he played in the establishment of our country? I mean, he died, 1628, 1627, somewhere in there, and yet, of course, his spirit is certainly exemplified in so much of what's going on today.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we need to, one of the things I say is that Washington, D.C. is a textbook of liberty, and if we actually learn about what is there, you know, that the idea of hidden in plain sight, those are the instructions. Washington, D.C. is a physical instruction manual, and if you read my book and other books like it, you know, you can go around and get an idea of what it is that you're supposed to study. There's a curriculum there. As you're walking through the streets, there's, you know, an attempt to convey a message, and some of the message I give and some of the message I'm still learning, and some of the message I think is suggested as areas of further study for generations of Americans.
And, of course, there was a fellow who wrote a book about the secret architecture of our nation's capital.
Right, excellent book.
And, of course, he goes into the background of this. I think the most Americans really are totally unaware that there is a secret architecture, which, of course, is very well covered in this book. What was his name? I've forgotten his name.
David Overson.
David Overson. But
yeah, it's an excellent book. But, you know, in his case, I think in some ways he overcomplicates things, you know, because if you look at what's actually right in front of you, if you look at some of the statuary, even there was the one in the one of the Commerce buildings that I pointed out that just shows, you know, a white man handing a bag of gold to an African native, receiving some grain in return.
Hold that thought. We're going to bring the stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. James Wasserman. We're talking about his book, The Secrets of Masonic Washington. And Mr. Wasserman comes from the point of view of belonging to a secret society. But he's been studying this, of course, for many, many years. Joined in 1976. He's been part of this movement. But he actually is trying to explain what is in Washington, D.C. Somebody called in and asked about Columbia. Why do they call the District of Columbia the District of Columbia? And, of course, he actually had pointed out that Columbia was, of course, a goddess, but actually she was, from the point of view of the founders of this country, the male counterpart of Columbus, because, of course, they looked, of course, to Columbus as having discovered North America, having discovered the Western Hemisphere, and, of course, they were very grateful to him, and they didn't want to call the area Columbus, so they called it Columbia, which was a female counterpart of Columbia, which I think is fascinating. And then,
absolutely.
Of course, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying I had said that the African native was passing back grain, but in effect, I'm looking at the image now. He's passing an ivory tusk. You know, he's engaged in trade with the European, handing the bag of gold to him. I think, you know, the lesson there, especially today, is that trade is not an exploitation of inferior culture by a greedy external culture. You know, trade is something that enriches both areas. There are so many different lessons, from the occult symbolism of astrology and the orientation of some of the buildings, particularly that David Ovison discusses, but then the kind of simple messages about work and values of heroism, sincerity, freedom, courage, determination. You know, some of these things are even in some ways more important than the so-called occult messages, because they talk about the values of a culture which I believe today is deeply in danger from forces that are that don't have our best interests in mind, that are looking to turn us into that voting ourselves into slavery for the promise of a little security.
Well, I certainly would tend to agree with you on that, and though I think we may come from different points of view, I found a great deal of information in your book that I tended to agree with, because I think that you value America and the promise of America as much as I do. It's, and simply the question is, how will we be able to preserve what we have been given from generations in the past. But you point out in your book, and so well, that so many of the major buildings in Washington, D.C., if you look at them, you'll find all this statuary there, and so many of these statues have occult symbology. And what the average American does not understand is what you say, and of course, actually, it's something that Manly P. Hall, who was a leading Masonic philosopher, said, a brilliant individual, and that is that the occultists have always hid their symbols in plain sight. In other words, they're there, but unless somebody points them out to you, you can't see them. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You know, because you look at someone, you know, holding a ram in his or her hand, you know, which is sculpted into some of the buildings that I show. And, you know, what you may not realize is that right next to her is someone who is holding, you know, or standing next to a fish, which is the symbol of water. And the ram being Aries and springtime is the symbol of fire. And, you know, you'll see these little angels kind of blowing wind at a figure of Mercury, and you know that's air, and you know, and then if there's you know, there's a large bull sitting next to those figures, which of course is the symbol of Earth. So there you have the occult teachings of the four elements. You know, you have the you have the square of Washington, D.C., shape, actually a diamond shape, but it's a square. And you have the symbol of earth, air, fire, and water, you know, here on the Department of Labor and the Interstate Commerce Commission. Everywhere you look, there's an occult symbol, and you may not even know it's occult because it's just so open. It's right in front of you.
Well, of course, you know, there's so many of the symbols that, you know, and the terminology, it has multiple meanings. For instance, the square and the compass of masonry with the G in the center. And some people says that represents God. And
absolutely,
you mentioned it may very well represent geometry.
Yes.
What about the possibility that it represents Gnosticism and the Gnostic beliefs? Or do we know what it really means?
Well, I don't think we know what it really means, but I think that Gnosticism is a beautiful idea. In fact, it's the first time, sir, I've ever heard that expressed.
Well,
but I show a picture, which I didn't make a federal case out of going into in the book, because it seems obvious.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Mr. James Wasserman. Of course, the thing is, it's very hard sometimes to know what the symbols of a secret society mean, because, of course, the reason they have a secret society is they're secret, and of course, the members are pledged never to reveal what they have learned, and so I think what you've tried to do is interpret the Masonic meanings, and yet, of course, some of them are so flagrantly Masonic. One of the things, of course, you point out is the emblem, certainly the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the triangle with a glorified eye. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? Because it is certainly one of the most flagrant Masonic symbols that we have, and yet it is also a symbol of the ancient mystery religions, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, it was not even put on, it was not even shown for many years until 1935. A die had never been struck of that design because people felt it was so overtly Masonic that it was almost embarrassing to them. But at the same time, it's an ancient Egyptian symbol, and the illuminated eye appears throughout all occult traditions. You know, the eye is all-seeing, and it shows the eternal omniscience of God. It's the all-knowing, all-seeing power of God. And centered in the triangle, of course, it's in the middle of the three elements, the three planes of existence.
But then why did they put it on the back of the dollar bill? Because, of course, why would they put an occult symbol on the back of our currency?
Well, it was put on the back of our currency by a Freemason named Henry Wallace and a Freemasonic president named Franklin Roosevelt. So they were trying to, show people that there was a spiritual heritage in America, and they were trying to create a symbol of power to help to broaden the, a life of America, one hopes.
All right, fine. Well, I think all of these things, are so much a part of America, and yet most people in this country have little idea of the occult traditions that are here, and of course that are playing in a very important part in I believe, and of course what is going on today, and even in America's foreign policy, which seems to be intent upon fulfilling the ancient idea of bringing these ideas of the we profess to people throughout the world as they unite the world. Unfortunately, I think they're going to create a disaster. We're going to be back in just a moment here. Hang right on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Wasserman, James Wasserman, who has been a member of the Secret Society for many, many years. And, of course, he's talking really about, of course, the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the triangle, the glorified eye, and he points out that, suddenly the eye is centered between the three parts of the triangle. And ordinarily you speak of four parts, why is the three important?
Well, because if you take the first point of the triangle and you think of the way that life manifests, the first thing that happens for existence to occur is that the infinite has to concentrate itself and reach a point. And when it does that, it has location. But in order to have some kind of relationship, it needs to establish a second point. And then you create, the line, the kind of two points of reference. But that goes on to infinity. In order to create something tangible, you need to make a third point. And then when you have the third point of the triangle, you have a self-contained plane. And from that plane, all of reality flows. And putting the eye in the center of that triangle is like the wisdom of God in the midst of the plane of manifestation, from there comes the solid form of the pyramid, and from there comes all other forms.
Well, of course, you point out that the triangle with the glorified eye was a symbol of the ancient mystery religions of Egypt and certainly of other societies down through the ages. It's always been known, and of course, then it was carried forward to become an emblem of the Masons and then put on the back of the dollar bill. And people look at it every day, hidden in plain sight. And, of course, there are really so many of these manifestations of the ancient mystery religions. What is the significance of the pyramid behind that, below the triangle of the all-seeing eye, which, of course, is a manifestation of the capstone. It's not settled on the top of the pyramid. But what is the significance of the pyramid itself? Because, of course, you know, a pyramid really has nothing to do with America as we look upon it, but there certainly would have something to do with the occult traditions of the people who were working here at the time. What is the significance of the pyramid, and why are we finding more and more pyramids being erected throughout our country today?
Well, the pyramid, of course, is the first manifestation of solidity. You know, it's the three-dimensional world of, you know, the ideal plane and the plane of manifestation. And, you know, the unfinished pyramid is extending up toward, you know, the perfection of its own completion in, you know, in that triangle, that capstone that you mentioned. You know, it's almost like it's trying to reach up to join it. But at the same time, it shows, I think, the manifestation of the Holy Spirit descending into matter and the idea that the whole of reality is informed by the world of the spirit. So the fact that it's unfinished is actually a beautiful testament to the humility of the founders and the idea that there is a continuous attempt to perfect the nature of this grand experiment.
And of course, would you say that the idea theoretically is when the grand experiment has been completed, and, of course, the world is united into the type of society that they want, then the pyramid will settle into place on top of the pyramid, or does that have any place in esoteric traditions?
Well, I think it has some place, and I'm not sure if it happens or not. We'll have to wait and find out, right?
Well, I don't know whether you
Neither
or I
do
will
I.
be around, but, of course, it's fascinating as we see the unfolding of the events throughout the world and what's happening here in America today. As many people are even beginning to question what's going to happen to our society. Will this wonderful society we've known and enjoyed and, you know, really survive? And, of course, that's a question I think everybody has to ask today. Well, let's get a little bit off into the story of the Templars and the Assassins. And certainly, what is the real message there? That the Templars and their influence for the mystery religions was transported to Europe and then the United States and became foundational for the creation of Masonry, or what?
Well, the Masonry, of course, that the Templars were attempted to be destroyed, at least in, you know, 1314, but many of them escaped. Now, there are some signs of Masonry taking place, you know, in the later 1300s, and people have made the assumptions or the assertions that these Masons were actually escaped Templars, and that they were teaching a kind of secret doctrine, and that they had learned, and that they had brought with them, and in fact was the reason that they had been killed. Now, there were many reasons that they were destroyed as an order, but they did experience a kind of martyrdom, and whether they were involved in heresy is still an open question. But I believe that they were, and I believe that the heresy that they were involved with was one of enlightenment. And I believe that they taught that through individual Templars reaching out and banding together with other escaped Templars and building societies such as Freemasonry, the Rosicrucians, and some of the other movements that flowered in the Renaissance and went on to lead to the Protestant Reformation and later the Enlightenment, and then the real strength of Masonry, and then the founding of America. So the answer to your question is a qualified yes.
Well, now, what about the influence of the Illuminati, which was formed in Bavaria in 1776 by Adam Weishaupt? What part did the Templars play in the philosophy of the Illuminati?
Well, I'm not actually a great fan of the Illuminati. I feel that they were... I don't know that the Templars played any role in the Illuminati. You know, again, the Templars were destroyed by 1314, so it's a little hard to credit them with starting a German organization 400 years later.
I'm just simply suggesting these ideas that the Templars...
I understand. Well, the Illuminati were were certainly prone to free thinking, and they were prone to a reevaluation of all of the values that they had built during, that had been built up in, European culture. They have been linked to the Templars because there is a very active legend, which may well, in fact, be true, that the French Revolution was fought to punish the French king for the sins of Philip IV, his, early predecessor, that Louis XVI was killed to atone for the destruction of the Templars 400 years earlier. And certainly the French Revolution was organized by the Illuminati to a large extent. And Pope, who had been co-opted by the French king to pronounce sentence on the Templars, was also undermined by the events of the French Revolution. The entire church, Catholic Church in France, was powerfully weakened by the events of the Revolution, and the Illuminati were very opposed to both church and state. And, as I say, people have accused the Illuminati of doing that in vengeance for the actions of the Pope and King in 1314.
Well, do you think that there's any evidence that the Illuminati still exists today in some form or another?
If they do, they're sitting in New York and Washington, D.C., and in The Hague and places like that.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly am. I fear that there are people, whether they're Illuminati or they're carrying on the traditions of the ancient mystery religions, there are people around it that are certainly leading, I think, America, indeed the whole world, towards disaster. Well, as far as the assassins...
I would distinguish the ancient mystery traditions from that negative influence. In other words, leading us to disaster, yes, but that would be the Illuminati part of it, not the ancient mystery part of it. I actually believe in my heart that the ancient mystery part of it, which is what I represent, is the antidote to those people.
Well, of course, the thing is that the ancient mystery, really, they had tremendous knowledge that they had been able to acquire, and certainly isn't there a great deal of the magnificent architecture of the Muslims? I mean, you look at the Golden Dome there in Israel, built in about 690 somewhere there in Jerusalem, and so much then of the architecture that we see in Europe, the magnificent cathedrals, wasn't a lot of this based upon the secret knowledge they got from the mystery religions?
Absolutely, and look what they did with it. They made temples to worship God. You know, today you have the people that are trying to start, are trying to lead us into the slavery of world government, being the modern Illuminati, are the ones who are the most godless of all.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. And so, but I think, you know, you look at those magnificent cathedrals that were built, you know, during, you know, what, 1200, 1300, 1400.
Sure.
And
sure.
You wonder how they were ever able to engineer them. And you look at that, you know, look at the Mosque of Omar, and I've been in there a number of times there in Jerusalem, the Dome of the Rock, and you look up at that ceiling and you say, how did they ever managed to do this almost, well, at least 1,300 years or more ago without any of the things that we have today, any of the magnificent means, of course, of measurement or surveying. I mean, this is truly a almost, well, it's a magnificent structure.
And look at the ancient Egyptian pyramids from, you know, several thousand years before that. You know, how were they able to move those vast stones into position, you know, without cranes and derricks, and, you know, how could they do that?
Well, do you have any idea? That is a question that I keep being asked very, very frequently. How do you think that they were able to do that? Do you think they tapped into the secret knowledge?
That's what I believe. I certainly don't know the answer for sure, but I will tell you there's a place in Florida, I'm not sure if you've ever seen it or been aware of it, called the Coral Castle. Have you ever heard of that?
I have, and I think I've seen some pictures of it. But yeah, why don't you go ahead and describe it for our listeners? Because I think it sort of parallels what we're talking about. What is the Coral Castle in Florida, and why is it important?
Well, the Coral Castle was built by an individual named Ed. I don't remember his last name, but he moved tons of coral into these unbelievable positions, and all by himself, in secret. No one has any idea how he did it. These things, in some cases, weigh 10 or 15 tons. He has a door that you can push with your finger. That is a 10-ton door, and if you push it with your finger, it just gently glides open. And no one has ever been able to understand how he did it. And he said that he used some spiritual principle. The government was doing everything it could to learn what principles he was using. He never explained it. And at a certain point, he was actually attacked by some local people, and he moved the thing at night and re-erected it at the very southern part of Florida. And, you know, it's an unbelievable mystery how it could possibly have been done. He says he used psychic forces. Go there, it almost looks like he would have had to. It's incomprehensible how it's simply incomprehensible.
Well, I think when we look, you know, back through history and we see, you know, that the seven marvels of the world and the Colossus of Rhodes, and I've seen replicas of what people think it looked like, and you wonder how primitive people could have really done what they do. The Temple of Zeus, even certainly there's some of the Temple Diana that still exists there in Ephesus, and you wonder how, you know, thousands of years ago they had such magnificent buildings. But then, of course, the Acropolis and so many of the other things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that many of these times they were tapping into this power there?
Well, that's what I was thinking. Maybe they were not quite so primitive as we think of them being.
All right, fine. Well, certainly these influences are here. The assassins still exist under the auspices of the Aga Khan. Is that right?
Yes, and you know, they have an extremely, from what I understand, they are one of the most advanced Muslim civilizations of all the different groups. They have tremendous prosperity among themselves. They share a tremendous interest in education. The Aga Khan has built hospitals and schools and done a great deal to help his people. He's also built institutions for advancing Islamic studies in Britain, and he endows a chair at Harvard, I believe. He's done a great deal to open communication with the West and to invite communication with the West. He's not one of these jingoistic maniacs.
And of course, I think it's interesting. Most people here in the West don't really understand the Muslim faith. We always talk about the Sunni and the Shia, but we never mention this other sect headed by the Aga Khan. What do they call them specifically?
They're called Nizari Ismailis. They're a very complex offshoot of the Shia. I explain in my book kind of how they came about, and it's a fascinating story, but it goes through so many, you know, ins and outs, and you know, it's definitely through the mirror kind of development, but it's a beautiful myth that they have of themselves, and they have been a very successful people. So I think that they've proven the elegance of their spiritual teachings by their success in life.
Well, now, what about the Sufis? Are they related to the Sufis then?
Well, you know, we feel that the Sufis are actually started out as Sunnis primarily, but you know, the Sufis were a mystical strain within that region, and I feel that the Sufis are the true inheritors of the spiritual tradition in that region, and I believe that they used Islam to teach their teachings, and I believe that they also are actually the ones who, when the assassins...
Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Go right ahead. The computer is going to get us one way or the other, so go right ahead. Finish your thought, please.
Okay, when the Nizari Ismailis were defeated by the Mongols, many of them went underground, and they went seamlessly into the Sufi community because their teachings were so similar. And the Nizaris were very mystically inclined, very deeply involved in meditation, and you know, very spiritually advanced people, and they moved in to the Sufi group very easily, and that is the teaching that I believe ultimately resulted in, you know, what I call this Renaissance and occult flowering of the West, because I think the Sufis truly are the holders and the inheritors of the spiritual mantle of, you know, really the Greeks, who inherited the spiritual mantle from the Egyptians.
Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website you'd like to mention, or do you have tell people how to get copies of your book?
Well, copies of my book, of course, are available on Amazon.com, and my website, Studio31, that's 31.com, I have signed copies of my books available, and there's a little discussion about me, and there are some other links to OTO and other places, and I'm just delighted to speak with you.
Well,
interesting.
I appreciate very much your coming on with us. Of course, I've been studying these things for a long period of time, and I think that you've helped to verify some of the things that I've always felt. And yet, they're so preposterous. What I tell people about the ancient traditions and the mysteries and the relationship to the amazing architecture of years past, why people look at me and they sort of smirk. But I'm sure they smirk at you as well.
They certainly do, and I can tell you, I'm not smirking at you, Dr. Stan. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I can tell that you've studied very deeply. Both of us are admirers of Manly P. Hall. I think that he was a magnificent teacher and a true spiritual man. I actually was fortunate enough to see him speak in the early 1970s in California at the Philosophical Research Society, and I'll frankly never forget what a powerful impression he made on me.
Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and I may call you and try to get you on to some of our other programs. God bless. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just say some people would be critical of me for putting on Mr. Wasserman, but I think that he gives tremendous insight into what we're really talking about. As we talk about the mystery religions of antiquity, and of course the part that they played in the magnificent architecture, the building of the pyramids, and certainly Mr. Wasserman is being a member of the OTO, Aleister Crowley Secret Society, has been studying these things, searching for the meaning of life, and I think we all are searching for the meaning of life. I believe that I have found it in the Christian faith, and I believe that the Bible is authentic. I believe there's only one way to God. There are other people who believe there are many ways to God, and I believe that they're wrong, and I think our job is to reach people. But at least we have to talk to them. We have to point out the fact that we can see exactly the same issues and have an interpretation on them. But I hope our listeners, after hearing this program, if you'd like, of course, to go ahead and get a copy of the program, they are available. We do talk during the time off. Why, of course, there's a tremendous amount of information there. And then, of course, we carry a couple of DVDs that go into this, but from a Christian perspective, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning will give you tremendous insight into much of what we talked about. And the second DVD that we offer, Riddles in Stone, The Secret History of our Nation's Capital. And you'll actually see the Philosophical Research Society that Mr. Wasserman had visited, where he'd heard Manly P. Hall. And, of course, the man who's picked up in Manly P. Hall's place is interviewed there, as well as our many Masons who are into the mystery religions and have tapped into the supernatural power. So we certainly can obtain information that you can have here at Radio Liberty, but those two DVDs, I think, to me, are among the most important things we have. They point out there have been two influences in America since its inception, one the Christian, the other the occult. And the occult emblems are hidden in plain sight on the back of your dollar bill, on your television screen when you turn on CBS, and there in the right lower quadrant, right lower corner, of course, is the occult eye. If you want to get more into the occult symbols that you see every day, the book Masonic and Occult Symbols by Dr. Kathy Burns, very important. So the things that we would mention, of course, would be my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will give you real insight into how this all fits together. And then, of course, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Riddles in Stone. I believe we still probably have David Overson's book, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And then, of course, I think that the program we just did is very important. You need to understand we're involved in a very real spiritual battle. It is not imaginary. There are supernatural forces out there. As Mr. Wasserman talked about the occult symbols there, these signs of the zodiac. They're in the Federal Reserve Bank. With the occult influence on our monetary system. And if you've never certainly read my little pamphlet on the history of money, or our three little pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. At the occult hierarchy, all of this information is available from Radio Liberty, and we recommend that you obtain it, and then, of course, you can get this information, and we hope that you will help us to disseminate it so that people will understand the true nature of the spiritual battle that's being waged today for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And we do hope that you'll get the information and then help us to educate others, because that's why I do what I do, 5 hours a day. Well, of course, we're going to be off for the next two afternoons, so we won't be talking to you until next year. So we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival, because if we don't have a revival, we're going to lose this country. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.